Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media, this month's Dover municipal election features a three-way race for the at-large seat on City Council. Our Roman Battalion talks to two of those three candidates this week, delving into the issues they see as critical to the future of the state's capital city. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also hear from a University of Delaware professor about his research into ice melt in Antarctica and its implications for oceans and sea level rise. And we learn how the Junior League of Wilmington's popular Kitchen Tour fundraiser is adapting to the need to move online this year. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Dover's April 20th municipal election has a single contested race, with three candidates vying for the at-large city council seat. And on this week's edition of The Green, Delaware Public Media's Roman Battaglia talks to a pair of those candidates, starting with Andre Bogarty. Bogarty is a human resources and labor relations professional originally from Detroit. He says he fell in love with Dover after being stationed at Dover Air Force Base.
How long have you lived in Dover?
Approximately 29, almost 30 years now. I was stationed here in 1992, and Dover's been my home ever since.
Okay, so you're stationed here at the Dover Air Force Base.
I was stationed here at Dover Air Force Base, yes. I'm a veteran of the United States Air Force.
Mm-hmm. And what do you do now?
Right now, I work in the field of human resources, which has been the lion's share of my career. I am currently a contractor with the federal government, where I'm an investigator, but I investigate ELR matters, employee and labor relations matters, negotiations, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
With unions and in management. So I negotiate issues that may come up within the workplace.
Mm-hmm. And I've actually talked with quite a few people who kind of were stationed at the Dover Air Force Base and loved it there and decided to stay here. Why did you decide to stay in Dover? What makes you love the city?
Oh, wow. What makes me love the city? Well, my family, obviously. You know, it's a great place to raise a family, in my opinion. Dover's been good to me. The city has embraced me as well, so it has loved me back through community service and watching my kids go to school here, and just everything about Dover, in my opinion. I mean, it's close to everywhere. If I wanted to take an hour and a half drive, I can be in any big city. I'm originally from Detroit, so I know what the big city life is about, and I loved it as well. But to raise a family, Dover's just a centrally located place where you can get a bang for your buck. It's affordable, and for me it's affordable, and it's just been a wonderful experience with my family. When I say family, I mean my friends in the community, people I've met who I've known for years. So I just appreciate what Dover has done for me. So now it's my time to try to continue to give something back to this great city.
Yeah. And that's what I was going to ask you next is, you know, what's motivating you right now to run for city council? Why did you decide that now is the time?
I think now is the time for me. One, it's just there's a need. I think I'm available to lend my expertise through life experiences, through professional experiences that I can contribute to a city. And when I say that, just to join the city council team, the individuals who have served on a city council before me and currently serving, and it's a yeoman's job. So now it's time to join a team to continue to build upon and address issues that we have. I mean, let's just admit, Dover is not the same. That doesn't necessarily mean it's bad, but it's not the same as it was in 1992 or even 2000. So I believe it's time for me with some experience in this, and not only that, just some resolutions and solutions that I believe that that I can add my experience in negotiating through union contracts and employing labor relations. I believe it would be an asset to the city council and to the city as a whole to get things done, to make sure that we understand that, you know, you seek those win-win situations and answers and some of the issues that we face. And as I've walked through the city, even more recently, I spent some time downtown Dover. I walked and spoke to business owners last Saturday. And the truth of the matter is everybody wants the same thing. It's just how do we get on the same page? And you know, everybody wants safety for our city. Everybody wants to make sure that businesses are thriving. Everybody wants to make sure that our infrastructure is sound and that we're prepared for the growth. Obviously, there's the homelessness issue and vagrancy issue, and that continues to be a hot topic of discussion. And everybody wants the same thing. It's just how do we get there? But my experience as a negotiator, with my love for the city, with my desire to want to better the city for everyone, I think that's what's driving me.
Mm-hmm. So you sort of witnessed not necessarily a downfall, but like a degradation in the city since you've been living here, and you think that your skills are necessary to help bring the city up.
I don't want to call it a downfall. I want to call it we're just experiencing what every town USA has experienced. We've lived through some times. I mean, whether it's economic challenges, whether it's now obviously the pandemic challenges, and there, you know, every city USA will experience some of this and has experienced what we're experiencing. So I don't want to call it a downfall, because our mayor, our police chief, our, you know, the city council, we're, you know, the things that they've done to sustain a city, other grassroots organizations have worked hard to, you know, to provide services as well. But I will tell you that we're experiencing more of what we would call bigger city problems here in our town. So, so it's just time for us to kind of think a little more macro. Some of the things that probably worked in the past, just, you know, we may need to add to that, or we may need to think a little. We may need to utilize what I call a softer eye and see things a little more broader, and use a little bit more resources and tap into other areas to see what they've done to address certain issues. Because, you know, again, that's Dover is not the big city, but we're experiencing some of the same issues as big cities, bigger cities. So that's the goal, to make sure that we tap into the resources. And again, it's not a downfall. We're just evolving as a place. I love Dover, and I don't ever want to say we're going backwards or anything like that. It's just the evolution of the times we're in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when you say, big city problems and thinking on a sort of macro level, are you basically mm-hmm. saying that, you know, Dover is just becoming this larger or more developed city, and there are bigger, different needs that need to be met in the city as a whole?
Yes. Yes. That and then more of them, more of them. You know, the population has increased because Dover is a great place to live. So people have, you know, I'm not the only one who's made Dover my home because of everything it has to offer, from a great educational system that you don't have to pay for, where if you were in a bigger city to get the education that we receive in public schools, you would almost have to go to a private school. So to be able to have the caliber of houses that you're able to buy, you get more bang for your buck and the tax-free. So people, you know, it's no longer a secret. So people have made Dover's home. So the populations grow. When populations grow, those other challenges come with it. Mm-hmm. And some good things as well. You know, there's good and bad with it as well. So.
Yeah. I mean, you've been talking a little bit about your, you know, qualifications and the things you could kind mm-hmm. of bring to city council. What do you think sets you apart from your opponents running against you in this race?
Well, and if I try not to focus too much to differentiate myself or focus on what my opponents bring. I just know what I bring. I don't want to speak, ill of either of them. I wish them nothing but the best. And if either of them win, they can count on me to be supportive. I will tell you that my professional experience lends itself very well to what we need to accomplish today. For example, one of the issues that we're going to have to come to a resolution to is not just homeless. There's an issue of parking meters downtown. There are individuals who want parking meters. There are businesses who don't want parking meters. So we have to find a happy medium, and that's going to come through negotiating. That's going to come to having, competent conversations, as I like to call, to find really, why each side's interests are where they are. And I have skill sets in developing in or getting to the root causes of why individuals have certain interests, and then find some commonality. So I do that for a living. I do that every day, all day. So I think that's kind of, I'll bring that. I also, not just downtown. I do understand that the at-large seat represents all of Dover. So, I think, it's great to know your city. I'm currently on a police chief advisory council, so I'm on that now. I'm working with our great police chief and the police force and their new community policing initiative. Well, listen, we can complain, but sometimes you have to get off the couch. You can't armchair quarterback the issues that we face in our city. So for me, I don't want to call it a difference. That's my motive. I don't want to speak on the other two individuals. My motive is to get in there, not armchair quarterback, and be part of the solution where we are. So I, again, nothing. I don't want to speak about the other two individuals because that's not what we need at this time, especially during this political climate. I wish them nothing but the best in their campaign, but I do consider myself a very qualified, competent individual who will serve the city who will be proud to serve the city and will do well in the role as the year next city council member here in our great city of Dover, Delaware.
Thanks to Dover City Council candidate Andre Bogarty for his time on The Green this week. Dover's municipal election is April 20th from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. at the Elks Lodge on Salisbury Road. More information about the election can be found on the City of Dover's website. And stay with us. We hear from the second of the three candidates in that Dover City Council race, LaVon McCutcheon, next. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. We continue our conversations with the three candidates running for the at-large seat on Dover City Council later this month. Next up is 28-year-old LaVon McCutcheon, a teaching assistant in the Capital School District. Delaware Public Media's Roman Battaglia talks to McCutcheon about his goal of inspiring other young people to get involved in politics, whether that be through activism, voting, or running for office.
Firstly, how long have you lived in Dover?
All my life. I'm a resident. I'm all my life. I was born and raised here. Mm-hmm. 28 years.
Yeah. What do you do right now for a living?
I'm a teaching assistant for Capital School District.
You've lived here all your life. Why do you enjoy and why do you like living in Dover?
It's a great city to live in. Like I stated before, with me living here all my life, like I remember going downtown to shop with family on weekends. I remember the loving neighbors, the willingness from the community to gather together, like the African American Festival. It was a good seeing people of all minorities there just enjoying themselves. It gives off a good energy and vibe.
Mm-hmm. And what motivates you or what motivated you to run for city council?
What motivated me to run for city council is change. I know a lot of people say, oh, yeah, I'm going to want to see change. Nothing ever happens. I actually do want to engage in change. I want to also get the youth involved. I want to help tackle the homeless issues. I would like to form an eco development team to find uses for the vacant buildings and such and the ill-kept buildings that are in our downtown and all around the city. And I would also like to get a better relationship among the police and the community. I would like to bring crime down in the city. A platform that I'm trying to push out is a mobile command center station in one of the high crime areas on New Street. And I would like the mobile command center to double as a mental health facility for anyone who has episodes. But the mental health facility will be ran by a specialist, not Dover PB.
Mm-hmm. So a couple of different things. You have public safety, economic development. It sounded like youth involvement were some of the priorities for you in terms of what motivated you to run for city council.
Yes, I feel like youth definitely needs to be involved. Youth isn't involved enough into politics, period. Youth is the future. It's time for youth to have the keys and get in the driver's seat to make change and to do, for themselves. A lot of youth doesn't know about political events, or some don't even know how to vote. I remember pretty much growing up that I've heard, oh, my vote doesn't count. Why vote? It's just I would like them to get them engaged, like to get them the knowledge, because, like I said, youth is our future, and I feel like someone needs to be in power that's younger. Like the median age range of Dover City Council is mid-50s, but the median age range of Dover is 30. We're more connected to society, we're more into things. And times are changing. It's time to change hands and give youth the keys, as I stated before.
Mm-hmm. So you want to act as sort of, an example for young kids who are or young people who are interested in getting into politics.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And talking about the, you mentioned the current city council. You'll be working with a lot of those counselors. How would you say, if you had to give a grade for the current performance of the current city council, what sort of grade would you give them, and what could be done better in the city council of Dover?
No necessary grade that I would give, because in my opinion, everyone is feeling like they're doing what they can, necessarily they're doing the best that they can in the role that they're given. So I wouldn't particularly give it a grade. That would grade them as such. So no specific grade that I would give. Like I said, everyone is doing what they can to the best of their capabilities and their powers. But there are aspects and a few ways that things could change. Just like I said, another thing that I will be pushing for is the electric company. The electric company has failed to change their turbines in over 60 years, which has lost a lot of revenue that could be brought back into the city for future basis. So with changing those turbines, then they can get back into generation capacity and for energy. And that's what the city council could have done before. And also, the city council could take care of downtown a slightly bit more. Sidewalks ajar, there's trash and such. I feel like that should be addressed a little bit more also. And it's brought their attention, my knowledge from speaking to store owners that are located in Dover.
Mm-hmm. So sounds like reforming or making some changes to the electric company stuff in terms of the turbines and things, and also downtown development is something that you'd like to see the city council focus on more.
Yes. And yeah, also eco development. I like to bring some eco development downtown, bring more businesses downtown and such, but that refers back to what I just previously said. With sidewalk to joint and such, that doesn't draw a business appeal to someone who wants to put their location there. Mm-hmm. If you want a prime location for your business, you want it to look like something.
Yeah. I know last election when I talked with Gerald Rocha, who recently ran for the city council and is now there. He's running and opposed this election, but he also mentioned public safety and the downtown development was a big priority, mentioning needing to bring more arts into the city. I think he talked about other places he's lived in before. He's noticed the arts community is what really made the downtown and the city vibrant as a whole. Would you agree with that sort of sentiment? Do you think that there needs to be something that's missing in downtown right now that could be added?
Yeah, I agree with that also. Just like, again, that goes back to what I would like to also push to do. I would like to form a relationship with Delaware State University, and they own the downtown sports center that a lot of people don't know. And I feel like that could also bring culture into the city because Dover lacks culture. And what I mean by that is with me bridging the gap and building a relationship with Dell State, I would also like to bridge a relationship with the school districts. And with me by doing so, you know, both have drama and acting and such. I was looking into maybe Dell State students, you know, shadowing the high school students and the aspects of things that they'd like to do with arts, drama, acting, and such. And then, like, maybe on Friday and Saturday, they could utilize the Sports Center and put on the show and give downtown something to do. And I feel that I fall into the art of natural arts and such.
Mm-hmm. So utilizing the schools that we have in Dover, including Dell State, and also the local public schools to, you know, bring some more arts and culture into the community.
Yes, and like I said, and that also gives the kids something to do. That gives the college students something to do also. And, you know, maybe I can talk to the president of Dell State or the director of arts at Dell State. And maybe the students could even get a shadowing credit for doing such with the high school students. You know, I want to make it a win-win situation for both. I want to bridge a great relationship amongst the city and the schools. And also, it'll bring something to do for the city. Mm-hmm. You know, you haven't heard of anything like shows at the Sports Center and, you know, I don't know how long, especially driven by the youth. Again, I'm getting the youth involved.
Mm-hmm. So building a better bridge between the schools and the city in order to bring more into Dover. Obviously, you know, a big important part of city council is representing the city and having a lot of knowledge. What do you think qualifies you to be on the city council? And along the same lines, what sets you apart from your opponents that you're running against?
Again, what I feel though would make me a good candidate to be on city council is I'm driven, I'm a hard worker, I'm dedicated to what I do. I'm open-minded. I have no problem cohering and working with colleagues because city council isn't just a one-man show. You cohere with your colleagues. You hear their opinions. You go on from there. Everybody comes up in agreements on something. This isn't just a one-man show. And I feel like I can cohere with my colleagues and come up with the best plan to move things forward and over.
Mm-hmm. So your ability to work with other people is a strength of yours?
Yes.
And then lastly, my last question would just be how, you know, being the at-large city councilor, how would you represent all the citizens of Dover?
I will represent all the constituents as equal. I'm already out in the community. I've been out on Reed Street with current city councilmen out there cleaning up. Then we barbecued. I've already been in the community with I partnered with the barbershop in town, and I gave haircuts to 20 kids for Thanksgiving. I provided a hot meal for the Shepherd's Place shelter, and I have gone to each district and talked to constituents and got input on how they feel things should be run, because with me being at the seat at large, I work for them. They're my constituents. They know what they like. They feel what they like. And I will take everything that they take into consideration if I get said seat.
Mm-hmm. Great. Awesome. Well, thank you, LaVon, so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
No problem. Thank you for reaching out.
Thanks to Dover City Council candidate LaVon McCutcheon and our Roma Battalion for their time on The Green this week. We'll have our interview with the third candidate in this race, Michael Lewis, on the next edition of The Green, April 16th. but all three interviews are available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And a reminder that Dover's municipal election is April 20th, 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. at the Elks Lodge on Salisbury Road. More information on the election can be found on the City of Dover's website. And The Green continues in a moment with a look at how the Junior League of Wilmington's popular Kitchen Tour fundraiser is adapting to its move online this year. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This month, Delawareans can visit nine of the finest kitchens in Wilmington and the Brandywine Valley. But unlike years past, the Junior League of Wilmington's Kitchen Tour fundraiser will be completely virtual. The event's chair, Tara Wheeler, recently chatted with Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about how this reimagined version of the tour was devised to provide an experience similar to what was previously offered in person.
It is one of our major fundraisers, and proceeds from the event support our mission and our work in the community. And of course, as you said, this year, we're calling the Kitchen Tour Reimagined. So we are going 100% virtual. We've never done this before. In years past, it was a one-day event held on a day in April where homeowners would open their homes to tour goers and chefs would do demos inside these homes and people could see beautiful kitchens and have great food. Of course, this year it's going to be completely different being 100% virtual. So we have virtual tours, we have cooking classes throughout the month, and I'd be glad to tell you more all about that.
Go ahead. Tell me all about it.
Absolutely. Okay, so this year, ticket holders will have access to self-guided virtual tours of each kitchen that's on the tour throughout the whole month of April. So some people say, what is this virtual tour? What exactly does this mean? So there's nine total kitchens on the tour. There's no rush to view them all in one sitting. You could take your time throughout the whole month because you'll have access to the virtual tours all month. So they're self-guided, meaning as long as you have a computer or a tablet, you can log in whenever you'd like to view each kitchen from the comfort of your home. There'll be product information inside these virtual tours that's from the designers. So, for example, if you'd like to know where the faucet came from or where the light fixture came from, that information is just one click away. The virtual tour tickets are also going to get you a free cooking class of your choosing. And we have cooking classes that will be hosted throughout the month of April inside of the various featured kitchens. So you get to see those kitchens again, and you get to see those chefs cooking there. We have we have the five classes that are set to be live on certain dates and times throughout the month of April. But if you happen to not be able to make it that night, it will be recorded so you could view it whenever you'd like after the class is completed. So we have virtual tour tickets are $30 a piece and include that free cooking class of your choosing. And then the cooking class tickets are $20 each.
All right. I have so many questions here, so yeah. Bear with me. How were these nine kitchens chosen? I mean, are they just in everyday John Smith's home, let's say? How were they chosen?
Well, they can be. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they are from our local designers. We have five different designers on the tour this year. We have Georgie, Craftway, Signature, Waterbury, and Cheryl Umbold. We do go through an extensive application process every year that we do the tour. And so these kitchens were selected by our kitchen tour committee. And they are gorgeous, but they are not out of reach for the average homeowner if you're looking to do a renovation. We do have one kitchen on the tour, actually, that was submitted by a homeowner, and she kind of led the design herself with her contractor. So, really, we were just looking for an assortment of kitchens, and you'll see everything this year from what's kind of been more trendy recently, the white kitchens, the white and gray and navy, but you'll also see some different kitchens with warm colors of chocolate and caramel, pops of color here and there. So we're looking for, you know, something different. And then you'll also see a little bit of the old blended with the new. We have one kitchen, for example, that has an old butler's pantry from the home that was incorporated into the new design. So we're hoping that everybody, you know, if you're looking for a renovation or if you're just looking to enjoy some beautiful pictures and videos of kitchens that you'll love, that there'll be something for you on this tour.
Are all these homes and kitchens, are they all in the Wilmington area?
They are. So they're all in the greater Wilmington Brandywine Valley area. And the reason for that is because we actually did have our tour originally scheduled, of course, in April of 2020, which was postponed. So usually we have we try to make those kitchens in an area that people can drive to in one day within a reasonable amount of time. So, you know, who knows what the future holds? Maybe in the future, if we continue with some virtual aspects of the tour, we'll be able to have kitchens from all over the state. That would be pretty cool. But this is our very first time, a lot of doing virtual, of course, and a lot of the kitchens from last time decided to stay on board with us. And it's been great. We've really appreciated the support of both the designers and the homeowners, and hope to have the support of the community, too.
All right, let's move on to the cooking classes, because you said cooking classes will be held each week during the month of April in the live virtual format, taught by well-known chefs, or?
Yeah, so we have five different classes. We have two main dish offerings. One will be by Robbie Jester of Stone Balloon Ale House, and the other will be Dan Butler of Toscana. And we have two dessert offerings. We have a vegan chocolate cake and a seasonal fruit tart. So those will be two separate classes. And then we have a really fun offering this year, which will be a charcuterie and mixology class. That will be together on a Sunday morning, kind of thinking brunch. So if you'd like to maybe, you know, sit outside with some folks with some charcuterie and drinks, you can learn a little something there.
Stop the madness. You're making me hungry.
Yeah, no, we're very excited to kind of host a variety of offerings. And again, you know, we will be doing some bundle sales soon as well. So if anyone wants to buy a bundle of all these classes, stay tuned. We're doing some flash sales so you can buy them all together for a discount. But we just hope that there's a little something for everybody. And again, if you missed the class, it's going to be recorded. So you can always watch it later with friends and family if you'd like.
Well, you know, the only downside to this is I do not cook. And, you know, because this is in a virtual format, you can't really taste the food unless you make it yourself. And then in my case, it probably wouldn't be edible, right?
This is true. Well, hopefully you learn a little something and improve your culinary skills through the classes. But I know some of the chefs are actually offering, they're actually going to be making something that they also offer in the restaurant. So if you don't like what you made or it didn't come out quite right, you could always go to their restaurant. And we're encouraging the chefs to offer gift cards and things of that nature to the people who are attending their classes. So if it doesn't come out quite right, hopefully you could visit their establishment in the future.
You could always feed it to Fido or something. I don't
That's
know.
That's true.
Hey, Tara, let's talk about the background of the Junior League of Wilmington. I want to talk about that background. And then give me the background for the kitchen tour. But let's start with the Junior League of Wilmington for people who are not familiar.
Sure. The Junior League of Wilmington is an organization of women volunteers. We're all about women volunteerism and helping the community. So from year to year, our focus area might change. Right now, our focus area is our initiative is called Stand Up Period. And with this initiative, the league is committed to raising awareness about period equity in Wilmington and the surrounding areas. And we're working toward ensuring that individuals have equitable access to affordable period supplies. And I know that's probably not something that's top of mind, or, you know, when it came to our league, we all had to kind of educate ourselves on this need. And that's what we're doing. We've educated ourselves. We're trying to educate the community. We're doing advocacy work. So that's our focus area right now. And all of our fundraising efforts support that area.
That is fantastic. We're talking to, again, Tara Wheeler. This sounds like a lot of fun. So talk to me again about ticket prices and where people can get more information and sign up.
Yeah, sure. So simply go to our website, actually, at jlwilmington.org/kitchen-tour. And there you'll be able to read more about the tour and buy your tickets. So the virtual tour tickets are $30 each. The cooking classes are $20 each. And don't forget, the virtual tour ticket also gets you a free cooking class. So we hope that provides a lot of value for everyone. And we've been doing this fundraiser since 2004. It has been our biggest fundraiser over the years, and it's a lot of fun. We know we have people who have been going to the tour from the very beginning. And we hope that although this is different, that we have everyone's support and buy your tickets. And, you know, our goal is to provide the same level of excitement around beautiful kitchens, good food, but in a safe and responsible way. And again, just all supporting the mission of the Junior League of Wilmington.
All the way back to 2004, who came up with the idea for a kitchen tour?
That is a good question. And actually, I'd have to ask leaders in the league. I don't know. I know that, you know, we have members that are called sustainers that have been in the league for a long time and have kind of retired. We call them sustainers. And there are sustainers in the league that I should probably chat with about how this came about. I myself have been in the league for 5 years, and I have been involved in this fundraiser for most of those years. So I'm happy to carry forward this great event, and I hope that all of our work really honors all those other chairs of years past and the people who came up with this idea back in 2004.
Thanks to Junior League of Wilmington Kitchen Tour Chair Tara Wheeler and R. Kelly Steele for joining us on The Green this week. And we close out this week's show next with Enlighten Me, where we learn about a University of Delaware professor's research into ice melt in Antarctica and the implications that has for oceans and sea level rise. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Antarctica is half a world away from Delaware, but the way its ice melts due to climate change will affect how much sea levels rise all over the world, including on the east coast of the United States. One researcher from the University of Delaware is trying to better understand how this melting happens, and he sets off to Antarctica next January to do just that. In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt talks with coastal physical oceanographer and UD assistant professor Carlos Moffitt about his plans for the 5-year research and education grant he received from the National Science Foundation.
You recently received an early faculty career development award from the National Science Foundation to study melting ice in Antarctica. So just broadly, what are you going to be doing with this?
So I'm a polar oceanographer, which means that I'm interested in the processes that impact the circulation and water properties of coastal systems in Antarctica, in Patagonia, and other regions that are heavily influenced by ice. And I'm particularly interested in the interactions between glaciers and the ocean. So this new project, which is funded by the National Science Foundation, has a research component and an educational component. The science is motivated by the very important role that Antarctica plays in the climate system. One of those is as a driver of sea level rise. Sea level has been rising because the oceans have been warming, and also because ice found on the continents has been melting. The ocean plays a key role in that melting process. You can picture this as the big masses of ice over Antarctica and Greenland, kind of dipping their toes in the ocean. And so these ice shelves and glaciers that we say terminate in the ocean, so they're submerged sometimes many hundreds of meters in the ocean, are being melted because the ocean is quite effective at that process. It can hold a lot of heat. So it's a very effective process. So as the ocean warms, it also melts the continental ice faster, and that also contributes to sea level rise. So that is the kind of the large scale, broad motivation of the work.
What specific questions are you going to be looking to answer through your research?
Right. So I have my work has two research goals. One is to understand how all that new water that is melting from the continent and entering the ocean is changing the coastal system around Antarctica. And that includes the circulation, the properties, and also potential impacts on coastal ecosystems around Antarctica. And the second goal is to better understand how the ocean is contributing to the melting of ice around the continent by measuring the amount of ocean heat that is reaching the ice, this ice that is submerged in the ocean and being melted by this warm water. And so understanding those processes is kind of key to improve our projections of sea level rise.
Right, because the mechanisms of the melt will influence the models in terms of how much melt and resulting sea level rise we can expect in the future. Is that correct?
That's correct. And so one of the, we understand quite well, we can measure quite well, one of the components of this process of sea level rise, which is the warming of the ocean. So if we put enough instruments out there, which we've done, we can measure that pretty accurately. But there's a lot of uncertainty about this melting process around places like Greenland and Antarctica. They happen in these very unforgiving places, which are, you know, they have very challenging weather. They're very hard to observe. And so, you know, one of the largest uncertainties about what's going to happen with sea level has to do with what is happening in these polar systems, where ice is reaching the ocean and it's being melted. So improving those, that understanding is a way to really improve our projections of sea level rise.
So you mentioned it happens in unforgiving places. Is that one of the reasons that we don't know much about these systems? Is that it's just hard to get in there and research and measure it?
That's right. So, you know, one of the big challenges in studying glacier-ocean interactions in Antarctica and other places is that they're very, very challenging. They're very remote. They're hard to access. And as I mentioned before, the weather can be extremely, extremely challenging. So some of my work relies on conducting cruises from research vessels and collecting data, mostly during the Southern Hemisphere summer, because during the winter, the whole, you know, that whole coastal area is covered by thick sea ice. So we tend to go during the summer. And so we use a set of different strategies to collect our data. And so one of them is, as I mentioned, research cruises, but also if we want to collect data for longer periods of time, we deploy instruments in the water that stay there for a year, or we use, which is what I'm going to be using in this project, AUVs, which are autonomous underwater vehicles. These are kind of very energy efficient vehicles that they look like a small missile with wings. And they are equipped with a suite of oceanographic sensors to measure water properties and currents. They can sample down to 1,000 meters, and they can sample for a pretty long period of time, maybe 6 to 8 weeks. And so are able to collect data for much longer and in a much more effective, cost-effective way than an oceanographic vessel can. So this is, you know, some of the strategies we use to conduct this research.
And when you mentioned one of your questions is going to be how the melting is impacting the coastal ecosystems, can you tell me a bit more about those ecosystems, like what kind of plants or animals are in them, if any, and what are kind of the stakes of, you know, how the meltwater would affect them?
Okay, so you can think about marine systems and as having a food chain, so having several organisms that kind of feed on each other. So the first one in that chain are the organisms that are conducting photosynthesis. So they're capturing energy from the sun and creating more organisms, right? So that is the equivalent of trees on continents. And so in Antarctica, we have small organisms, certain species of what we call phytoplankton that are the first step in that chain. And after that, we have organisms like krill, Antarctic krill, which is a small kind of shrimp-like species. And this, the krill is like a fundamental step in the Antarctic food web. And after that, you have penguins and whales and, you know, elephant seals and other organisms that are feeding on krill, or they're feeding on each other. And so in terms of my work and how that influences this whole food chain, stratification, so where that water, meltwater ends up and how it's changing the surface properties, it really is a main modulator of the productivity of that first chain, step in the chain, the phytoplankton, and then the krill that feeds on the phytoplankton.
And the meltwater, why would it change things? Like, what about it is so different than the normal seawater that these organisms are living in?
Right. So when meltwater enters the ocean, it's lighter than the salt water that was found there before. So it reaches the surface and it makes it creates an environment with different properties. So that meltwater is lighter and it makes the stratification of the surface water higher. That means that it can make more difficult to mix nutrients that are deeper in the water column and making that water harder for that water to reach the surface. And sometimes it can benefit the productivity of that phytoplankton by creating an environment that is closer to the light. So if you imagine being a phytoplankton in the ocean, this small organism that is trying to capture light from the sun is a little easier if you're closer to the surface. And if you have very low stratification, that means that it's much easier to be deeper in the water column, which makes it hard to capture that light.
So talk to me a bit about the education piece. And some of that's going to be local, correct?
That is right. So one of the project has a very significant educational component that is the nature of this grant. So we're going to be working together with 8th to 12th grade teachers from Delaware and to talk about environmental change, including climate change, and using polar systems as models of those changes for students. So we are expecting to have professional learning institutes during the summer where we will work with about 10 to 12 teachers per year to develop grade appropriate climate science lessons so that the teachers can take them back to their classrooms and use them with their students. And the idea is to really, it's not a kind of a one-way street. We're really trying to collaborate with them and to learn about their processes in educating children and also kind of provide material for their lessons.
Carlos Moffitt, University of Delaware Assistant Professor and Coastal Physical Oceanographer, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks to University of Delaware Assistant Professor Carlos Moffitt and our Sophia Schmidt for enlightening us this week. And that's all for this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green can also be found via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Report for America Corps member Roman Battaglia, along with Sophia Schmidt and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. The Green is taking a spring break next week, so we'll see you again in 2 weeks here on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.